From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The Deputy Mayor of Alice Springs, Jacinta Price, recently won a pre-selection battle against the Nationals' Northern Territory Senator Sam McMahon. So Price becomes the country Liberal Party's Senate candidate at the next election. This essentially assures her of being in Parliament because the Territory returns one Senate seat to each side of politics. Price will be bringing to the Senate a controversial conservative Indigenous voice, critical of what she labels a paternalistic approach to Aboriginal autonomy. McMahon, who is a supporter of Barnaby Joyce, sits in the Nationals party room, but Price has yet to confirm whether she will do the same or sit with the Liberals. Jacinta Price joins us today. Jacinta Price, your mother, Bess Price, served in the Northern Territory Legislative Assembly as a member of the country Liberal Party. Was she an important influence in your own decision to enter politics?
Yeah, I think my mother's been a huge factor, I guess, throughout my life and certainly along the road to politics. She has been, and I guess I'm lucky in a sense that I've had the opportunity to watch and learn from her experience as a cabinet minister in the territory government and all that comes with that, the ups and downs of politics, the idea that, you know, if you want to enter politics, if you want friends, we get a dog. That certainly is true. And the fact that you have to be tough. You have to develop a thick skin, and I'm really grateful that I've learned a lot through watching my mother go through that experience, and it has certainly inspired me to along my own journey in politics as well. Yeah,
just give us some feel for your own background. What have you been doing? What did you study?
So in terms of my my education, I started an arts degree, which I didn't actually complete. I have a certificate at 4 in museum practices, and I was very much involved in the art world, in the art industry, working as assistant curator at our Araluen galleries at one stage, working at the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory, and specifically, obviously, with Indigenous art. And to me, that was about, for me, it was about understanding. Since I was a little girl, I was taken through what art meant to us in our family, and Tjukurpa stories and paintings specific to me and my dreamings. And that's where largely that sort of background came from. And I was a singer-songwriter as well. I at one point established my own production company, producing the children's television program Yamba's Playtime, and touring a musical production to remote parts of the country for our early childhood audiences. And then I think I began to talk about the issues more publicly around the high rates of domestic and family violence. Probably very well, I took the stage in the national platform at the National Press Club address in 2016, which I guess launched my national platform speaking on that particular issue. But it was in 2015 that I had decided, because I had been talking about these issues prior to that, to stand for the Alice Springs Town Council by-election. And having served on Alice Springs Town Council since then, and also as Deputy Mayor since August of last year, 2020, I guess all of this has culminated to the point where I am now. And having spoken out about the issues in remote communities, having grown up with experiencing domestic and family violence within my extended family, becoming a victim myself, I felt I was, I guess, well equipped to tackle this particular issue and to talk about the reality of what goes on in within families, within communities, and certainly growing up, understanding my traditional culture, being close to my family, I could see what elements within our own culture was, I guess, contributing to these high rates of violence. And I think I was just sick of attending funerals constantly of family members whose deaths were very easily preventable, you know, had died from alcohol and violence and those sorts of things. And I felt I had to really take a stand. And I guess once I have known, you know, something, or you know the truth about something, you can't unknow it. And if I wasn't doing something about it, I felt like I had become part of the problem, and I couldn't live with that. And so much of that is the reason why I've been driven to take this path and this journey.
We'll come back to some of these issues in more detail in a minute. But just first, you've not said which party room you'll sit in. Why are you delaying this, and what are you weighing up, and when might we know?
I guess because we haven't had the election as yet, and this decision isn't entirely up to me, but it is a party decision as well. And it's not something that I want to jump to right at this point, I guess, when we know who's won what seats. I think that's a better time to form that decision and form that decision with the party. And I've spoken to senior members of the party about this, and that's the that's what's been decided on, I guess. So, yeah, that's why I'm not prepared to confirm anything at this point in time. I don't feel like there is a point right now until we know the results.
So it's post-election?
Yeah, it's a post-election decision.
What do you think of Barnaby Joyce?
Oh, look, I think Barnaby is a very passionate individual. I know that when he speaks, when he acts, when he does something, he is certainly heard, and that's certainly what the Nationals appreciate in him. Otherwise, they wouldn't have brought him back as the leader of the Nationals. I've had some great meetings with Barnaby. I feel like he has, particularly, I guess, the last time I was in Parliament, and I'd taken Sharon Long and her sister Misha to Canberra so their voices could be heard. I felt Barnaby engaged quite, the young ladies really appreciated their meeting with Barnaby because he listened to them and certainly wants to be able to act in their best interest and in the interest of Indigenous women and children in remote communities. And that's something that I certainly appreciate about Barnaby, and I know that the young ladies that met him certainly appreciated that about him too. And look, he's certainly someone that I know I can work with, definitely.
Now, to come back to your activism, you obviously have different views on some critical issues to other Indigenous people who are in the Parliament, but do you think that you would find scope to work across the political spectrum with your Indigenous colleagues here in Canberra, or would the differences of views simply be too great?
Look, I think we there are in many ways we want the same things. It's about how we, you know, what direction we go to get those things, to you know, make those sorts of steps towards advancing Indigenous Australians. And I feel I can certainly work with other colleagues, Aboriginal colleagues, particularly I think from the Northern Territory as well. I mean, I've already had Marion Scrimger, she spoke to me a couple of weeks ago, and she approached me and said that she'd hoped that we would both get in, and that she looks forward to working with me on a number of issues regarding Indigenous Australians. So, I mean, I have Marion Scrimgeour had in fact had appointed my mother to the chair of the Indigenous Advisory to the former Henderson government when Marion was the minister back then. And we've always, I guess, had a respectful relationship with Marion. You know, the territory is a small place, so everyone's connected in one way or another. Mullundurry and I are distantly related. So there's certainly opportunity, I believe, that we can work across issues for the benefit of marginalised Indigenous Australians, definitely.
More generally, obviously, Aboriginal leadership is quite fractured. Do you get much blowback from within your community for being quite conservative?
Yeah, look, I think anyone in a leadership position gets blowback from their detractors. I think it's the same for if you're a non-Indigenous leader as well. Quite often, you know, people don't say to white leaders, well, you know, the white people in your community don't sort of like you or that sort of thing. I realize there's an Indigenous conservative, well, an Aboriginal conservative movement taking hold in the country, because I think there are a lot of Aboriginal people out there who feel as though they are more conservatively aligned and that they get the kind of pushback that I've got, and some aren't prepared to put themselves out there because of that, whereas others are saying, you know what, I'm sick of this. I want to be able to just be me and push in this particular direction. And that is happening. That is definitely happening. And look, I will always have detractors, no matter where they are. And a lot of the time, I think a lot of people are misinformed about what it is I'm trying to achieve and how I'm going about trying to achieve those things. And you know, for some people who don't necessarily like me, I mean, they tend to think that you know, I want to take away the rights of Indigenous Australians, which is far, far from and complete opposite to what I want to do. I want to encourage Indigenous Australians to be less dependent on government, to be able to stand on their own two feet. If the greatest freedom comes from taking responsibility for one's own life. And so I don't like the victim mentality, because I believe that removes a person's agency. And that's the worst thing you can do for someone if you in fact truly care for them. And I think, you know, sometimes people can get to the point where they realize that, okay, that's actually a good thing. That's actually the way to go. And that's what I want to encourage in others. And I'm always very happy to, I'm open to having conversations, difficult conversations, and sitting with people who might not understand where it is I'm in fact coming from. And if we can agree to disagree, or we can come to points where we realize, well, hey, there are places here where we do agree, and let's find a positive way forward to work together to overcome some issues.
Now, you spoke before about your concentration on the problem of domestic violence. What are some of the other big policy areas that you intend to pursue?
So an issue that I'm very passionate about is the opportunity for Indigenous Australians and traditional owners to be able to create business opportunities, own their own homes on their own country. And right now, the way the Land Rights Act, which is federal legislation, obviously, but only enacted in the Northern Territory. A lot of traditional owners, and in my own experience as a traditional owner, have not had the opportunity to be able to access their own country for economic development opportunities and or have the opportunity to own their own homes. There's an example in Manangreta, even where they were in need of a new clinic,
And because of the size of the community and the fact that they service not only their community, but also surrounding communities and outstations, the problem is that they desperately needed a new clinic to be able to take care of people living out on those lands. And the unfortunate issue was the fact that they could not get access to land to do so, which I think is utterly ridiculous. And, you know, according to the UN Convention, Human Rights Convention, it is a human right to be able to own your own home. And as it stands, Indigenous Australians, traditional owners, through the Land Rights Act can't do this.
Is this a problem with the legislation as you see it, or is it a problem with how it's operated?
I think there's two things going on. So in terms of the legislation, you know, you obviously the land is not freehold. It's inalienable land, and it's communally owned, if you like. Now, I don't see... aside from that, there's the process of traditional owners having to apply for a Section 19 lease application. So through the land councils, and so it is ultimately up to the land councils to grant them the opportunity to have access to their land, and very rarely does this opportunity ever come about. So you have to ask who actually does have control of the land, which is supposed to be under traditional ownership. And to me, I see this as it's being owned by the Commonwealth entity, which are the land councils and not the traditional owners themselves. Because I have many traditional owners come to me with their concerns that they simply can't. They even if they wanted to, they can't start up a business enterprise or a joint venture to create jobs in their communities. You know, they can't gain access to land to even build a house that they'd want to be able to live in themselves. And you know, this when other Australians in the country are able to do this, and traditional owners can't, I see two different systems going on, and I don't believe there should be two different systems that hinder one group of people in this country. And so this is something that I'm obviously very passionate about, because it means that, you know, we talk about, you know, you hear a lot of activists talk about sovereignty. Well, what about economic sovereignty? Indigenous Australians should have the opportunity to be economically independent, just like other Australians across the country. If they're economically independent, it means there's adults in jobs. It means the households can be improved. You'd see rates of domestic and family violence decrease, and kids in school if parents are in fact working in jobs.
But you would also want that land preserved for future generations, wouldn't you, rather than, for example, sold off in a freehold way?
Well, the decisions, I believe, should be ultimately with the traditional owners. And right now, as it stands, the decisions are being made on their behalf. That notion that you've just expressed is you know, the notion of others, but what I'd like to know is what the traditional owners actually want for themselves. I mean, I'm not saying sell off huge parcels of land, which is usually the argument that is contrary to the argument that I'm trying to present. I'm saying let traditional owners make decisions about their own country and what they want to do with it. Why shouldn't they have the opportunity to own a piece of land in their own right, just like other Australians, that they can hand down to their children and own a home on that piece of land? You know, we currently live in private land ownership and communal land. I mean, the minute you pull out of your driveway of your property, you're on communal land, which is public land. And as I see it at the moment, what we have in remote communities is, I guess, socialism at play. And these are the places where we have the most marginalised people in the nation living. And clearly what's been happening for the last three decades is not working. We can romanticise this idea that it's all about, you know, Aboriginal people having their connection to land, but where they're actually living in those townships themselves, why can't they have a piece of that land to themselves? Yes, the rest of the country, the whole of the nation is sacred in terms of for Indigenous Australians. You know, I understand that relevance because I have, you know, Ngapa Tjukurpa is my dreaming, rain dreaming. I know the country associated with my Ngapa Tjukurpa and Waluklongo, which is fire dreaming. I know the country associated with that fire dreaming. But as far as I know, there are vast amounts of land, in my part of the world, utilising elements of that land for the benefit of economic sovereignty, the opportunity to be economically independent from welfare. I just don't see why we can't have both in this day and age, why we can't have both that connection to land and also using elements of that land to be able to be independent, stand on our own two feet, and those things can't go hand in hand. You don't have to swap one for the other, I don't believe.
Couldn't you have some better leasehold arrangement, for example, so that you don't lose this notion of land rights being really communal land through the generations?
Well, I don't think it's even losing land rights. I think it's strengthening land rights of Indigenous Australians. And ultimately what I'm saying is these decisions be had by those traditional owners as to what direction they want to go in terms of their own parcel of land, their part of the country. Because, I mean, I've had traditional owners from around Noongarrwa who have said that they have wanted to get access to their own land, which is theirs under the Land Rights Act, to start off a buffalo safari and go into joint venture with private enterprise to be able to do that. And what's stopping them is the fact that their Section 19 lease application is not being put through. The land councils have not processed it on behalf of them. And in some circumstances, you know, you've got private investors who have invested money already to set these sorts of things up and that have gone nowhere. So there's been a loss. And, you know, for Indigenous Australians, why can't they have the same opportunities as others to do that? I think it's wrong that there are these two systems in that regard, keeping Aboriginal people poor. And they want to be able to attract investment. I mean, you know, I think it's infantilizing Indigenous Australians to think that they can't set up their own businesses on their own land. If they fail in some of those operations, then let them fail, let them learn from that and get back up on their feet and do it again like any other business person has been able to do so. But we need to get to a starting point for that to happen first. And recognise that Indigenous Australians are human beings like everybody else and capable of creating opportunities for themselves.
Just turning to some other issues, how important do you see constitutional recognition of Indigenous people and pushing that issue, and why has it been so hard?
The idea of constitutional recognition, it's not huge on my list of priorities. It's not right up there because, in practical terms, I'm sort of more focused on practical measures that are going to generate outcomes. I think if we can get it right at some point, I think the reason it's taken so long is trying to get it right, that process. And I don't mind the idea of being recognised in our nation's constitution. Obviously, we have to take all Australians along with us to make that decision come to fruition. But as I said, I guess I'm more focused on the more immediate practical issues trying to provide outcomes for the betterment of Indigenous Australians, as opposed to, you know, symbolic gestures, if you like. So, yeah, I'm okay with the idea of it. It's not a priority for me at this stage.
And what is your attitude on the question of a voice to Parliament, which was part of the Uluru statement?
I've not been a fan of the voice to Parliament because, again, I don't trust the process of how that is supposed to be. I in some ways see it as another opportunity for those who have been heading up the Indigenous industry to remain in those positions. Personally, I'd like to see if the Indigenous industry no longer existed, it'd mean that Indigenous Australians would be on the same footing as all other Australians and wouldn't require an industry to lift us up, but would be part of the fabric of the nation just like everybody else. And I don't necessarily think that an additional voice to Parliament is going to get us there. I think, you know, I'm really proud of the fact that I've been pre-selected to be a voice. I'm proud of the fact that in South Australia, Karen Little, who is an Ngarrindja woman also from Alice Springs, was pre-selected to run in the next federal election as well in the Senate. And so I think we do have Indigenous voices in Parliament. I guess it's upon them who have been there already to actually be doing a better job, if you like. I mean, if we need a voice to Parliament, then clearly that's saying something about the representatives who have been there already. So I just think we should, I don't like the idea of us being divided along the lines of race within our nation. And if we're reaching for equality, true equality, then that means that Indigenous Australians be on the same footing as all other Australians. And like I said, I don't know what's involved in the voice to Parliament. I think there are a lot of Aboriginal people out there who don't quite understand it. The processes that took place to get us there did not involve all Aboriginal Australians, but those who were prepared to go along with that narrative. So again, from the outset, I don't have any faith in the process. And you know, the Uluru statement's a lovely statement and it's feel good, but it doesn't outline our responsibilities as Indigenous Australians with the issues that we've faced and what we're prepared to do ourselves to stand on our own two feet. So I'm less for feel good statements and I'm more for practical and measurable outcomes.
Jacinta Price, thank you very much for joining us today. And that's all for this Conversations Politics podcast. We'll be back with you with another interview soon. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.